You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 31st, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report on a Michael Monday. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, author, columnist, scholar, Rafia Zakaria, on her new work, essay, Empire and the Overpass, part of a larger project on inequality and the climate crisis. We're going to talk about Pakistan. We're going to talk about why global warming is still best understood in global justice and inequity terms. Rafia Zakaria joins us. Donald Trump, the extremely fit, competent, healthy, emotionally and otherwise, and totally safe pair of hands running our country, or tantruming our country, was throwing fits all last week. Healthcare, the filibuster needs to be gotten rid of, even though that's not why Obamacare wasn't repealed. He's threatening to take away Congress's insurance subsidies and, of course, subsidies for millions of vulnerable people in an intentional destruction of law. And Lindsey Graham, that great maverick, what an amazing new solution to get repeal through. Keep the tax regime, but essentially block grant Medicaid. Great. And Democrats moving one step forward, one step stuck in inertia. New rash of technocratic fixes to Obamacare, but not a bold new advocacy of no BS healthcare, Medicare for all. Here's a card. Here's your health care. And new polls show that Iranians think if we break the nuclear deal, they should restart their nuclear program. Even as the administration attempts to undermine the deal, even while the State Department continues to affirm that the Rouhani administration has mostly kept its end of the joint agreement, Saudi Arabia, in a back channel meeting with a prominent Iraqi cleric. Is this an indirect overture to Iran? Apparently, Saudi Arabia's horrific, devastating reign over Yemen is costing the country some money as oil prices are still low. And Scaramucci's such a real man. He's not there for the birth of his fucking kid. He's got to go to the president's friggin' speech. It's amazing to think of the varieties of human experience. I think anybody here will absolutely go out of their way, if at all possible, to miss things that Trump says, unless it's sassy Trump doing it. And this guy was like, yeah, kid, whatever. I want to just out of the gate say to everybody that today is the last day to nominate us for the podcast awards. This is a big deal. We've won it four times. We've got to make it five. You go to podcastawards.com. There'll be a link on our website. And you just nominate us for best news and politics. Best news and politics.
We don't want to beat a dead horse here.
Well, I think Bernie is correct.
We want to win that. Yeah. I want to win. I want to be able to put that on my LinkedIn. That's really all I'm here for. That's what I show up for in the morning. So
that's the best. That's a dark horse for funniest comment that's ever happened in this office. I want to tell you a bit about Blinkist. Blinkist voice is smart but not stiff, informal but not sloppy. The world's most successful people, Al, have one thing in common. They are hungry for knowledge. They read and learn every chance they get. And since you're listening to the Majority Report, you probably feel the same way. And that's why they are introducing the Blinkist app. Over 2,000 best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. Learn the essential ideas from the best books in your field or subject you never knew you loved, like productivity and business and science. With Blinkist, you can feast your mind on ideas from nonfiction books like Thinking Fast and Slow. That's a really fascinating behavioral economics book. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People in the 4-Hour Work Week. All on your way home. More knowledge in less time. Not to mention, their team is constantly adding new titles from best of lists, so you're always getting the most powerful ideas in a convenient, made-for-mobile format. No wonder Blinkist was chosen in Apple and Google's best selection for 2 years. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority to get a free trial or 3 months of your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist.com/majority to start a free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/majority. The Michael Brooks Show's debut is happening next Tuesday evening. Not sure the exact start time yet, but it will be in the evening. It will be the public version of the show that we will stream live over YouTube and podcasts, similar to the Majority Report. Members, I think, are going to get a little taste of something later this week. And the Slack group is already open. I was on yesterday hanging out with people, talking a little bit, and most importantly, people are talking to each other. We're at 393, which is awesome. I can't thank everybody enough. That's an incredible honoring vote of confidence before we've even started. And I want to thank Robert and Zane and Alex, who had some significant contributions, as well as always the team that's helped me put this together. It's closer and closer. I'm very excited about it. If we get to 400 by tomorrow, we get a matching $500. So be the last 7 people to push us up to that 400 mark. And then, you know, keep signing up and we'll be right out of the gate soon. I know Matt doesn't portray it, but he's extremely excited. It's just not his style.
I like to keep things low key and then people are surprised.
Yep. That's been the whole approach that you've taken to emotionally manipulate this audience and office. Now, here's another great way of accessing information, texture. You know about the Texture Act. We've talked about it. You can use it to curate your favorite magazines and writers and have your sort of personally tailored, delivered magazine experience. It's kind of Netflix, but I would actually say with a better equivalent selection at this point, although you know, Netflix is improving a lot. And so many of us get our news from social media, but we need more than just opinions from friends to stay informed. So you do want, as part of your diet, things like, obviously, The New Yorker for longer form pieces, The Atlantic, and Vanity Fair. You can get them all in one app. Magazines keep us informed on news, social issues, give us moments of inspiration, comic relief, just when we need them. With the new app called Texture, you can get access to all of your favorite magazines in one place on your tablet or phone. The Texture app has gone beyond delivering just the magazine itself. They've made it easier for you to find and enjoy the articles that you want to read with daily recommendations, exclusive interactive features, videos, and more. And as I told you, everything from Vanity Fair, New Yorker, Fast Company. I follow specifically several authors on the platform, Dwell. It's a nice way of sort of balancing what I need to read and stay up with for my job with a much broader set of interests. Texture is searchable. You can mark what you like, check on back issues, view bonus video content, and they even curate articles and magazines just for you or whoever you're giving Texture to this year. Texture is normally $9.99 a month, and you get over 200 magazines. But if you sign up right now at texture.com/majority, you get a 14-day free trial. Why subscribe to just a couple of magazines when for way less you can get all your favorites on your smartphone or tablet all the time for way less? Plus, Texture was selected as one of Apple's top 2016 iPad apps. Start your free trial now. Download the Texture app. Right now, Texture is off. And as I say, it's offering listeners a 14-day free trial when you go to texture.com/majority.
That's 14 days to try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/majority. Texture.com/majority. We will be right back with Rafia Zakaria on the Majority Report.
The pressures of your life and it tough. Now stay down, mama, time, pick it up. Now bother with the down, full style, strictly up, full vibes. Now pick it up when the bills, them, the rent and the mortgage due. Yeah, yeah. When me chalice, when your best friends are gone and it's only you. Yeah, like a past lift, turn up the music. Skanking sweet, everybody wanna feel like free. Forget your troubles and the feel a reggae music sweet, yeah, yeah. Skanking sweet, everybody wanna feel like free. Forget your troubles and you rock with me. You know, feel a reggae music sweet, yeah, yeah. Skanking sweet, for every pain there's a melody, yeah. For every trouble there's a harmony that brings everything together. So make we sing together. And who said life no order? And every man got this struggle. I beg you to help me, Lord. And let me overcome my troubles. Skanking sweet, yeah. Everybody wanna feel like free. Forget your troubles and you rock with me. You know, feel a reggae music sweet, yeah, yeah. Skanking sweet. Everybody wanna feel.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Rafia Zakaria. She is a scholar, author, columnist for The Baffler, The Dawn. She's the co-editor, I believe, with Vijay Prashad, or she has a piece in Vijay Prashad's edited piece, Will the Flower Slip Through the Asphalt? Writers Respond to Capitalist Climate Change. Rafia, thank you so much for joining me again.
It's great to be with you, Michael.
It's always such a pleasure to talk with you, and I like you have a very integrative view of the world, and you tie a lot of important threads together, and I think give people access to, I mean, multiple perspectives that are completely lacking in most of the discussion. But I want you to situate, before we get to the specifics of your essay in Pakistan, that subtitle, Writers Respond to Capitalist Climate Change, is very interesting because there's been a couple of discourses on climate change. There's a, you know, kind of broad technocratic and managerial response, which is that this is an engineering problem and through some, you know, combination of technology, policy, we solve it. There's been a response to climate change that is maybe more that is more political and adversarial, but maybe more narrowly partisan in the sense that, you know, if we, you know, Democrats over Republicans, as an example. There's also been cultural and even kind of, for lack of a better word, like spiritual critiques, the way this relates to our kind of broader relationship to the natural world. All of these things have use, but it's definitely a new emerging strain, at least I think in bigger discourse, larger kind of quote-unquote mainstream discourse, to connect this kind of defining crisis with inequality and with capitalism itself as the actual core engineering problem. So could you talk about that perspective and the inspiration behind this project?
Yes. You know, the core idea is obviously the one you got to in terms of looking at this as part of capitalist expansion and, you know, connecting the dots for people in exactly how the environment is being throttled by these by this kind of impetus. And one of the reasons, of course, is that we wanted to do this is, well, there's two, I think, main reasons. The one is that I think people don't connect the dots. I think there's a dearth of arguments that reveal just how that core idea of sort of dominating the land and, you know, this constantly the competition for resources and the fact that dominance over resources suggests a victory of some sort, how that translates into empire, and how that is replicated again and again in different environments. The other, impetus behind this piece in the book in general, of course, is that there's an internal critique of the work around climate change and environmentalism as not really inclusive of voices from the global south and not connecting the experiences, the everyday experiences of people in the global south to the consumptive habits, both of their own elites and, you know, are largely of empire. So the book tried, and my essay in it tried to, it was ambitious in that sense. And so that's why I tell the story kind of the city that I grew up in, of Karachi, and what is happening there, both in terms of land reclamation and neoliberal development around, you know, around the beach. And then off a very particular overpass that was constructed in on reclaimed land and, you know, on and threatening what is essentially one of the most threatened ecosystems in Pakistan, which is the mangrove forest. Now, those of you who have some kind of ecological understanding know that mangroves, especially those around coastal areas, are absolutely crucial as both in preventing erosion, also in as like a natural water filter. And so the story of this overpass is essentially, I mean, it boils down to the fact that it was constructed by and large to provide a direct access route of the military supplies for U.S. troops that were unloaded at Karachi port and then needed to make their way inland and across the border to Afghanistan.
So let's
at
just,
a very high speed.
Yeah, so let's that's the kind of amazing sort of, and just, I mean, disgusting story sort of at the heart of this, and quite literally disgusting. You'll explain that in a moment. Let's reset just a bit, but I would like you to maybe, if you can, kind of use this as a bridge, because you start with this incredibly, like, really just noxious kind of image of basically people, basically waste created from, like, luxury homes and hotels in Karachi, which is not filtered, not, you know, there's no sort of public infrastructure for it. It's basically released into local waterways and people swim and wash in it. There's a kind of story in the sort of symmetry of the climate crisis and the class crisis in Pakistan. I want you to talk about that, but I think that just to add to what you said earlier about you know, voices in the climate debate, it's very interesting because attached with those kind of categories that I mentioned before is there's been like a kind of like high-end moral glamour with the climate movement. Yeah. There's been a lot of like it's the elegant, it's the smart people of the sort of, you know, the global elite, and they meet and they sort of and it's funny because, you know, conservatives and their sort of stupid kind of blunt instrument cynicism, but they've always had those kind of winning lines like, oh, you're going to go solve the climate crisis in Davos while you fly in with your private jet and, you know, do like fair trade Coke in your bathroom before you have like some, you know, marathon session about solar panels or something. I mean, it's invited itself to that critique. And in the process, it has kind of eliminated a much broader kind of policy and scientific and activist contribution to understanding the problem. And then it's also, you know, it's pushed out of the whole zone of conversation the people who are already having the results of climate in their lives every day. Like, this isn't like something that's going to hit. It's already affecting it. So maybe you could talk briefly about the broader point and then bring us into the water of Karachi.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail exactly on the head. I think there's been this kind of slice where the left movement or the leftists among in the climate change movement have been vulnerable to kind of a moral elitism, which, I mean, to be really frank, draws from a development narrative that originated in the colonial era, right? Mm-hmm. Which says that, let me come and show you how to do this, or let me teach you how to protect the environment. And there's a great danger in that kind of implicit message, and the great danger is the fact that it doesn't recognize, first of all, that the consumptive habits in most of the developing world are very different from the habits, obviously, in the global north, and the consequence of that is that it eliminates the reality of these everyday impacts that people in Pakistan, people in Beijing, people in Nepal are experiencing. You know, climate change is not sort of a remote abstract discussion for them. And so, you you pointed out, of course, of what happened on the right, but you see how both strains of that debate essentially squeeze out the people whom this is a very proximate and daily reality. You know, on the right, there's like this denial and this kind of, right, you know, crude cynicism. And then on the left, there is this sort of savior mentality where it's like, we figured this out with our scientists and let us tell you. And, you know, on a personal level, of course, that really bothers me because I definitely grew up. I grew up in Pakistan. I definitely grew up in a family, and this can still be seen. I mean, it's perhaps not as common as it used to be, but a very different ethic of consumption. You know, a very sort of a commitment to recycling that was not glamorous. You know, for instance, I mean, there's no piece of paper, I think, in Pakistan that gets thrown away. Mm-hmm. You know, the newspapers go and then they're made into bags, and then the bags they're made into something else. And so mainly because we don't have the resources, we have to use everything. You know, every you know thing we buy has to have many uses. And in that sense, there is this sort of you know, respect towards a kind of a limiting consumption or respecting the consumption that you do engage in. That, you know, when I came to the U.S., for instance, I'm still shocked at like this idea of garage sales where people, you know, they buy all this stuff and then they'll have a garage sale and they'll get rid of it, but then they'll go right back out and buy more stuff. And so these are habits that are peculiar in a sense to the Western way of consumption. And I really worry that the environmental movement here, at least on the individual level, has really gotten reduced to kind of a performative political act, right? So I'm going to make a big show of the fact that I'm collecting all my bottles and recycling all my paper, and I'm going to judge you if you're not doing it, rather than a real assessment of what kind of comprehensive changes, both in individual consumptive behavior and, you know, politics at large, have to happen. I still don't see those, quite frankly. I mean, just this weekend, there was an article in the New York Times about flying and what it does and how, 11% of all emissions in the U.S. are because of air travel. And, your one trip from the New York to L.A., emits as much as your car does in an entire year. But there's very little talk about things like that, there's very little emphasis on changing those sorts of behaviors, or the idea of, like, you know, I'm entitled to travel and see the world as an American, and one that is accepted on the left and the right and pervasively. So all of this, of course, is, it's a squabble that's happening at the top of the people who at the top of the consumptive economy of the world. And the people at the bottom, of course, the people in Karachi that, go to the beach because that's the only place to go to get some recreation. Most of them don't have running water in their home. And so to go to the beach and, take the plunge in there and have an afternoon and an evening there is, is the idea of fun, and also just to get away from the very tiny, cramped spaces they live in. And then, I talk about the fact that the ocean, particularly that beach that is most frequented by millions of people in Karachi, Sea View, is just absolutely filthy. I mean, there are literally homes and elite clubs and banquet halls and malls that are all dumping their waste into this ocean. And everybody is taking a bath in it. Everyone else, the poor are taking a bath in it.
Right. So this, what's so just grotesque about that image is how, like, it literalizes the way we do, the way the world system works today. Like, that is basically what's happening structurally, and that actually is it in Karachi, which is that you will swim in my filth. There isn't even, like, a concern
right.
for it.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. Yeah. It's a metaphor.
Right.
It's definitely a metaphor.
And you trace the whole system, and I want you to get back to what you were talking about earlier with this mangrove forest, but you also connect it with the fact that a lot of these poor people in Karachi are also people that are fleeing areas of what we would call here high kinetic activity so that they have been, through a chain, and you'll work it to the mangrove forest. But if you go to, certain areas of Pakistan, a victim of, extremist gangs, as an example, a victim of U.S. foreign policy and errant and drone strikes, indiscriminate drone strikes, and then of what is also called I don't know even how euphemistic this is, a Pakistani army cleanup operations. And I don't think anybody who has, any sense of skepticism about anything would have any doubt as to what that would sort of look like. You would have to be extraordinarily naive or like a paid PR rep for the Pentagon or the Pakistani government to not understand what that means. So that people are getting dislocated through terrorist groups, through Pakistani military, through our foreign policy. Then they go to Karachi, where they go into the filth of the water. And then the ecosystem of Karachi is threatened because we need transport lanes to get munitions into Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, you've summed it up. One of the stories that I worked on, a longer story that was published a couple of years ago, was about what you're talking about in the northwest of Pakistan, the area that I think Americans best know as the target of drone activity. And I was working on this story about this one town in which, you know, this girl had been abducted, and it was the story surrounding her abduction. But the backstory around it was exactly the fact that there had been a gypsum mine in this town. And once the gypsum mine was opened, all the men that worked the land, you know, had were small subsistence farmers or had herds of goats, were immediately, you know, went and started to work for the gypsum mine. And then when it shut down, they had to then go farther and go to Karachi or to the Gulf, you know, to work on oil rigs. But, I mean, the story behind that is precisely of how this kind of resource extraction for export, you know, has essentially doomed so many small towns in so many parts of the world and created opportunities, I would say, for extremist groups to, you know, profit and recruit in that vacuum, which is exactly what they're doing. And they'll continue to do, because once you disrupt, you know, you've changed the ethic of that community from the ethic of this is my land and I have to take care of it and it sustains me to an ethic of I got to get this stuff out of this land and sell it for as much as I can. Or rather, I'm going to be, you know, the human sort of cannon fodder for this human pawn for this extractive enterprise, which is then, you know, going to sell this stuff to build the buildings, you know, the buildings that stand along the beach in Karachi, because gypsum is an ingredient of cement. And so once you've changed that ethic and changed it to an extractive ethic and a profit ethic, there's really no going back. And, you know, so, I mean, even those connections, I think, are missed. I mean, just last week, there was news in Nigeria, for instance, of, you know, some researchers, they were calling them researchers and security troops that had been attacked by Boko Haram. Well, I mean, you know, that's a story there in Maiduguri in Nigeria. The fact that these people are coming, they weren't actually researchers. They were all oil company prospectors who are coming to see, you know, where they can set up their drilling operations. So, again, you have another example of, you know, an extremist group right there that is, you know, working within this extractive economy because they know that the people, as soon as these operations fall short, there are huge amounts of youth that are left out of that economy, and then the extremism becomes sort of an avenue for them. But I'm very frustrated at the fact that those connections are almost never really engaged within the climate change discourse in the West. I mean, I don't think people understand that, you know, I hear a lot of language about urgency. We have to act now. We have no time. We have to go to zero emissions. I agree with all of that. But the fact is that, you know, in this sense, the people of places like Pakistan, places like Nigeria, are already seeing their lives devastated. Their livelihoods, their, you know, sense of belonging. I mean, a lot of the unrest that is happening in a lot of parts of the world is because, like you said, like, you know, you explained in Karachi, there's economic migrants that, you know, once that gypsum mine shuts down, okay, well, we got to go to a different city now to get a job because now there's no jobs here. And then the kind of subsistence farming knowledge that existed a few generations ago before the mine opened doesn't exist anymore. So now they've got to go to Karachi where now they're going to, you know, well, there's no jobs in Karachi. Well, let's see if we can try to go to the Gulf and work on an oil rig over there. So, I mean, essentially what you have is a complete, you know, tearing apart of cultural life, of communities, of families. And you have this kind of demographic chaos, which, of course, you see in the political impact. So, So, I mean, you know, I'm hoping that people can try to look at how these overtures in the Middle East or what is happening are very integrally connected to what the West has failed to do on climate change. And that those voices need to be, I mean, they need to be in leadership rather than kind of, you know, the patronizing, okay, well, you know, here you go. You can write a little bit too about this.
Right. Well, and also what strikes me is that you can start to think of these things as all extractive industries. Like you have the, you know, the oil, the terrorist groups and the oil industry and the cement mixer are in obviously in radically different ways, but they're all just extracting and streaming through human life essentially. And that is the kind of like, you know, you can, and also there's anytime there's revenue streams and they're interested in getting access to revenue streams, it's pretty obvious. And I guess that kind of leads me to my last question. And I'm not sure how to formulate this, but I'm not someone who's purely a materialist, and I don't think everything comes down to resource explanations at all. I think, you know, there are culture, you know, matters, our belief systems, you know, obviously the West's exploitation of the global South, as an example, is not purely just a function of drive for resources. There's an ideology behind it. There's belief behind it. So all of these things matter. Right, whether we're talking about the United States or Boko Haram or whoever. But I do wonder, I'm noticing what's hard in, at least for me in Western discourse, is that there are American conversations about terrorism and security, is that it gets so abstracted so that like this whole conversation, like you can understand what's happening in Afghanistan or Pakistan because of like, I mean, you know, the dumbest version is if you just read the Quran, you get everything that's happening, obviously. But even slightly more sophisticated ways that like this is about a battle of ideas and this, you know, all of this kind of like tug of wars. And when you ever dig into it, from our role there to the conflicts between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban right now, which as far as I can tell seems to have a lot to do with who controls like heroin shipments, frankly, like that seems to me like the most preeminent concern there right now in terms of conflict and fighting. Do you think that as part of that broader perspective that needs to be integrated so we can actually fully solve these problems, that people who are on the receiving end of these policies have a much greater innate sense that it's like this stuff is about real things. It's about resources. It's about who gets what, where, when, and how. And there's less kind of like airiness in the conversation so that when we start turning our listening and we finally shut up a little bit and listen to a Pakistani or a Nepali or a Nigerian policy approach, it will be more grounded in that and lessen this kind of abstractions that we seem to get fixated on, if that makes any sense.
It makes complete sense. And, you know, it's part of this kind of obsession with national security, this, this creation of experts that, you know, the whole creation of experts, and I would include terror experts, and even perhaps to some extent climate change experts, is that it devalues people who have experience. And it's a sophisticated, revamped way of the same kind of epistemological dominance that originates with colonialism. It's this idea that let me tell you what your problem is,
and
it maintains sort of this idea that, you know, the people who are suffering are sort of not really. I mean, they're too emotional, they don't know the science, they're, you know, too close to the problem, whatever. I mean, you know, a whole host of excuses, and it maintains Western dominance over the discourse of climate change. And you're absolutely right, this doesn't exist. I mean, yes, everybody in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, particularly in Nigeria, knows that the core of these issues, it has a very, very central and crucial resource component that is not being acknowledged. And, you know, the reason for that is simple. I mean, it kind of goes back to the people bathing in the filth. You know, well, we'll throw our filth in there and you take a bath in it. But, you know, nobody wants to sort of embrace the moral cost of that. And so it's this idea, you know, the left wants to still preserve this idea that they're somehow not as complicit as the right, in climate change, because they're sort of concerned about it, or they drive a Prius, or, you know, they recycle their cans and glass and newspapers. But they're not willing to sort of do, you know, what is ultimately the central problem, which is, you know, change their behavior in a radical way, give up things like travel that they love to do, be prepared for, sharing resources. And for acknowledging their complicity in what the people on the beach in Karachi are bathing in.
Rafia Zakaria, the essay is The Empire and the Overpass. The book is Will the Flowers Slip Through the Asphalt? Writers Respond to Capitalist Climate Change. And I just want to say, Rafia, the only terrorism expert I've ever heard you speak with any respect, at least when you've been talking to me, is Sebastian Gorka. So I did want to note that.
God, what a nightmare. I can't believe you're throwing that at me right
now. You know I had to. Come on. That was so levity-free, Ruffy. I needed to mess with you a little bit at the end. Come on.
I was wondering which terrorism expert this is going to be. Because I
Gorka.
Can't think of a single one. This is Gorka.
You said that to Gorka. Me one time in one of our conversations. You said, I don't agree with all of his prescriptions, but Sebastian Gorka has a very sophisticated grip of what's going on in northern Pakistan.
The era of the pajama boy is over.
This is sort of the conversational equivalent of bathing in the filth.
Yes.
You know? So
yes,
where
it
it's
is.
Like you jumped into the ocean and bathing in the filth.
That's part of how I make my living, Rafia. I can't stay in the hotel all day. Rafia Zakaria, she's also a columnist for The Dawn and The Baffler. I appreciate your time immensely as always, and I hope to talk with you again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rafia. Okay, everybody. We're going to go to the fun half. The IMs are on, 646-257-3920. Tons to get to. Nominate us at the Podcast Awards, podcastawards.com. See you in the fun half.
All the time, she said, no, 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 no. Like to speak my mind, she said, no, 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 no. And I know her time's not free. She didn't waste none on me. Situation sad. No, no, no.